This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. My guest today is the poet and labor activist Mark Nowak, who is the author of an amazing new book called Coal Mountain Elementary, which combines accounts of the Sago mining tragedy in Morgantown, West Virginia, with news clips from coal mining disasters in China, and with excerpts from the American Coal Foundation's school lesson plans, if you can believe that. There are also incredible photographs of coal miners in China by photographer Ian Tay. Mark Nowak, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks for having me on the show.
No problem. How'd you come up with the idea for this book?
Well, when the Sago mine disaster happened, about 6 weeks later, I was invited to a college, Davis and Elkins College. That's about 15 miles from the mine. And I was there for a week as a visiting writer. And I just started driving around the community, shooting photographs, many of them that appear in the book, and doing workshops with students and other community members and trying to get the story. And that year, the testimonies came out, the interviews with the miners, the rescue team members. So I read through probably about 7,000 pages of testimony and tried to come up with what felt sort of like the story. But as I was doing that, I got onto a listserv by this organization called the Mine Rescue Association to find out new information that was coming out about Sago. And I kept getting every day updates of mining disasters in China. 17 miners die in an explosion. 200 miners, Chinese miners die in a flood. So I wanted to try to find some way to balance that local, transnational, or like West Virginia and China so that people could get a sense that this thing that happened in Sago that was covered so much for several days in the news was happening each and every day in China.
And some of the accounts in China are incredible in this book that you show, just the total callousness and insensitivity on the part of the Chinese government.
Right.
And they're denying the problem, they're covering up the problem, they're trying to pay off the survivors in small amounts.
Right. Or reporters with cigarettes and bottles of wine.
Yeah, it was incredible. You have a testimony early on in this book from a Chinese woman. Do you mind reading that?
Sure. A 40-year-old woman has been waiting in a small room about 50 meters from the mouth of the Sungjiawan Colliery since Monday afternoon's underground explosion. Compared to other distraught relatives clustered in the meeting room, where miners usually gather before descending into the hole, the 40-year-old looked rather calm, a witness said. As a miner's wife, she said she had prepared herself for this day, but still it came too soon. We didn't have the traditional New Year lunch together because he had to work, she said. His only day off was Lunar New Year's Eve. We cooked dumplings. It was a good time. Her husband had been eager to get back to the hole, his wife said, because he could get double pay on New Year's Day. She said she was not particularly sad, but feared the scene when the dead would be brought to the surface and laid out in cold rows on the ground, awaiting identification. I have no language for my feelings, she said, and there's no way anybody else can understand it.
And yet you try to make people understand it in this book. It came too soon. That is an echo that you hear throughout from the victims' families, that their fathers, their husbands in their 30s or 40s taken from them. There's another quote from a surviving daughter, I believe, or son. I think it's a daughter. It's a daughter, Li Ying, who had just this. I don't know how you found these quotes, but some of these quotes are incredible. This one stuck out to me. My dad didn't live a single day of a happy life, but I'll try hard to earn a happy life for my mother. What an astonishing indictment of coal mining life if the dad, who was a coal miner, just could not extract a day of happiness from it.
Right. And we hear that story over and over, I think, throughout this book and throughout these stories that repeat almost every day. I mean, when the book started, I started a blog for the book in which I'm simply updating coal mining disasters around the world. There was one yesterday in Pakistan in which a number of people died, in South Africa, in China, in Zimbabwe, all across the globe. It's really almost an everyday occurrence.
And is this intrinsic to coal mining? Is there no way to make coal mining relatively safe?
Relatively, but as I was thinking about it, I think besides maybe active military, there's probably not another job out there in which you really have to worry about whether you're going to come home alive at the end of every day, and that so many people are dying.
So it is intrinsically dangerous, and then the private coal miners or the country-owned coal mines,
right,
as in China, everyone has an incentive to cheat.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, in China and through this book and, reading the news reports coming out of China, you see that each and every day. I mean, there's more of a crackdown now. There's more stories coming out about government officials being put in jail for their role in this. But there's still a long way to go. 3,500 miners are still dying every year in China.
And this isn't a didactic book. It's a book that you have to induce or deduce the lessons from, rather. The book is called, again, Coal Mountain Elementary. I'm speaking with the author, Mark Nowak. And yet you can deduce that, a lot of the products we're getting from China and the globalization that we hear about rhapsodically still in some places in the U.S. media is not so rhapsodic and comes at a great cost. You restrained yourself, though, which was an interesting choice, not talking about or editorializing about that or the environmental effects. Why did you restrain yourself?
Well, I didn't want to be standing on a soapbox and preaching. I wanted the story to seep in as it did to me when I was reading those 7,000 pages of testimony and getting those sort of daily news reports, that it would be just this, like you would read that quote that I started with, and then just slowly over the course of 160 or 170 pages, that story would unfold over and over. A lot of readers have told me that, they'll almost feel like they want to skip one of these Chinese sections because it's just almost, it feels like the same story over and over again. And then they say, well, how can I, here I am ethically, like I'm going to skip a story about 17 people dying in a mine collapse or 80 people dying in a flood.
So they're only a paragraph long, too. So
right.
You've got to really want to skip over, though.
Right.
And how'd you hook up with this photographer, Ian Tay?
I had found another photographer who had done a lot of work around 1999, 2000 in China. And she was on to a different project, but she said that she had a friend who was just starting an 18-month project on the Chinese mining industry. And we really just hooked up via the internet and Skype and those tools while he was there. And he would send the new pictures each and every day. Not each and every day, maybe every few weeks one would come through. Or a set of them would come through, and I just started placing them, pairing them, seeing what he thought about them. But I knew that I had my photographs from West Virginia, and I wasn't going to be able to go to China for the kind of length of time I needed to do this. And so the collaborative process really ended up being a great process to put this book out. And I think his photos are just stunning. And he's
great
an incredible
photos.
Photographer.
Did you go to China at all?
I was in China before, but not for this particular project.
What were you there for?
Just to go around and, do some writing and studying.
I like some of your photos in this book. The one that I'm looking at now is hard hat, hard toes required. This is a sign in the middle of on the side of a narrow road in the middle of the snow.
Right.
And what is that sign telling us?
It was a sign that was on a dirt road at a coal company near the Sago mine, but it was an old tipple that had collapsed that someone who worked there at the mine wanted me to see. And as I was driving, I saw that sign, and it's obvious in the photo that it's been there for quite a long time, and it says something to me almost symbolic about the mining life that From the bottom of your toes to the top of your head, you need to be protected and on guard because this is a dangerous place that you're entering for your livelihood and your family's livelihood.
Mark Nowak, have you ever gone down in a mine?
I've been in mines up in northern Minnesota, the taconite mines, but in not in the
there?
Coal mines. Yeah, but not in the coal mines in West Virginia.
Now, the Sago, the story of the Sago mine is a very gripping thread that runs through this book, Coal Mountain Elementary. And you said you just coincidentally went to the area around Sago for a writing or speaking project there, teaching project. And at what point did you start to talk to people who were coal miners there or survivors of coal miners?
Well, from very early on, I mean, it's hard to be in that part of the country and not have interactions with people whose uncle, whose brother, whose classmates in school were miners. So almost immediately upon getting there, people in the workshops that I was teaching would start telling me stories about similar things that had happened, you know, to uncles, to brothers, to parents. And actually, I formed a really good relationship with that community outside of in Elkins, West Virginia, at the school. And when I worked with the testimony, I turned it into sort of a historical drama. And in 2007, they staged it one day as a play at their theater. And when the book came out, they not only put it on as their spring production, they did a stage version of it at the school in West Virginia, but they also took it on the road and did it up in Pittsburgh, did it in some small towns in West Virginia. And one of the most powerful parts of that were that family members whose one, I think it was her brother-in-law, and another who was a cousin who died in the Sago mine, came to the production, spent a long time afterwards with actors and actresses and the director and myself talking about it. And the general consensus was that it was painful to live through because it was so accurate, but they were happy that the story hadn't been forgotten, because in a lot of ways they felt like there was this massive national news media there, Anderson Cooper, CNN, and then, you know, a week later there was no one covering the story, and they were happy that it wasn't being forgotten.
Mark Nowak is the author of Coal Mountain Elementary, which talks about the Sago mine disaster from a couple years back in West Virginia. And it also deals with coal accidents in China. And there's also a spoof, though it's you have to deduce that yourself. It's a spoof of propaganda from the American Coal Foundation. The thing that stuck in my mind always about the Sago mine was the mine disaster was just the horrible pull and tug of emotions, where the people in that community were told that there were 12 of the 13 miners there were still alive after days of wondering, and then that turned out not to be true. And there's some really compelling testimony in here about that. Did you talk to anyone about that particular wrecking and wrenching of the emotions?
Yeah, that, you know, the people who came out for the production, that was one of the things that they really picked up on from the stage version of it, that it felt like exactly that sort of waiting period that they went through, and that, you know, they had in certain ways before the announcement came that they were alive were starting to try to wrap their brains and hearts around the fact that their family members, you know, because of the CO2 numbers, et cetera, were probably not going to make it. And so they had started that sort of grieving process or that process of acceptance. And the next thing they knew, this news came that they, you know, like a miracle had happened and that their family member was alive, only to find out a couple later so that was utterly untrue. And to me, that was one of the most gripping parts of the story that, you know, unfortunately, this history of mining disasters, both in the U.S. and around the globe, happens far, far too often. But this seemed yet like another level of tragedy piled upon that initial one, that the family members had to go through this acceptance of it. Maybe not their family members not being alive, finding out that they were alive only for that information to be proven not true.
And how did that bad information get spilled?
You know, there's a number of different theories about that. Part of it was that because of the national news media, they had helicopters above. Geraldo Rivera was there. They thought they were tapping into – the media was tapping into their shortwave radio communications, that they put together a code and that they wouldn't say a body or a deceased miner. They would say an item. And the word supposedly came over that we have 12 items, but people thought in the rescue operations thought that was they had 12 bodies alive. And so, of course, in this, you know, digital age, someone probably picked up their cell phone. They had a neighbor or a cousin or someone across the street at the Sago Baptist Church. The word leaked out only once it was confirmed to be 12 bodies. Then that news had to be passed along to the families as well.
Do you want to read one of the accounts? I think one of where they get the happy news. And then we can talk about the delivery of the sad news too.
Sure. And this one is it's across the page from one of Ian Tay's photos of a number of Chinese miners, and you can't tell whether they're emerging from the mine or descending into it. And part of the process of the book was to get people to hopefully try to think simultaneously across these national borders. So as you hear this voice of the Sago story, you're simultaneously seeing an underground situation in China. I heard the announcement. We have 12. We have 12 alive. I looked amongst others in the room, waited on the reaction, because I didn't see anybody jump. And then I seen somebody pump their fist. Then I realized that they had heard the same announcement that I did. I made a comment to someone the other day that I had touched the ceiling tiles when I jumped. I couldn't believe the announcement. I just thought it was fantastic. Then I took off running. I came in the back door, run out the side door towards the front of the mine office, screaming, yelling.
That's Mark Nowak reading from Coal Mountain Elementary. And then 20 or 30 pages later, you get to another person who has to go notify people in the church. He thought that people already would have heard the fact that the good news had been false, and that he gets to the church and people are still smiling, and he can tell that that actually they haven't received it yet. Do you have that passage? It's on 157. This was really hard to read too. Do you want to give that a spin?
Sure. So I know it's somewhere 2.5 to 3 hour time frame went by, but from my perspective, it all went by very quickly. It took an inordinate long time to get from the mine office over to the church due to the crowds. And then at some point, we went to the church, and it was my understanding that the families had been notified already. It wasn't until I walked into the church and looked out on the crowd and saw all those smiling faces and all that happiness that I realized that they had not been notified. So the news was broken. Just the opposite of the jubilation that had occurred 3 hours earlier occurred in that church. It was just gut-wrenching.
That's Mark Nowak again, reading from Coal Mountain Elementary. The news was broken. You know, the passive construction of that sentence struck me. Editors are always looking out for passive constructions and wanting to change, because the way I read it, the person who was talking delivered the news and could just not confess to the fact that he had to deliver such heartbreaking news himself.
Right. And you see that over and over in the testimony. It's almost impossible for the other miners to say the person had died. Like wherever you get to where that word or phrase would be, an ellipsis turns up in the testimony, because it's just too hard to get oneself to say that even months and months afterwards.
And what was the responsibility of the company here, International Coal Group?
Right. Well, I think there were a couple things. One of them was that there had been a history of false alarms or problems with the carbon monoxide detectors. And in fact, in some accounts, one of them went off about 20 minutes beforehand. Another was a larger question about the safety options for miners underground, whether there are enough oxygen masks, whether there's enough materials for them to build airproof shelters. I think all of those things sort of came into question. production. And particularly in this era where industries are cutting costs over and over, I think it becomes a very valid question. There's a photograph really early in the book. I think it's the second or third photo in the book where there's a pile of coal and there's a sign for a mining company. It says, Mining Company Incorporated, safety protects people, quality protects jobs. But the name of the company is probably the company itself has been bought and sold so recently and so many times that it's spray painted out in green. And so one has to think that if the company doesn't have enough money to put a new sign up outside its operations, what kind of funding they're putting into, you know, safety materials and safety devices within their own
mines.
And
you found that sign yourself?
I found that sign myself.
Oh, you must have kind of jumped for joy. It's such a ridiculous sign upon stumbling on it. It's like stumbling on a good story. The compensation, what compensation did families get? What happened to the company? How did the story end, really?
Well, you know, the story, as I have put it together, ends with a obituary of two of the miners who actually survived that day. And to me, that was one of the largest costs for the families. You know, when we do these tallies, we get this number that X number of miners died, but it never takes into account the effect on the families afterwards. And in September, late September or late August and September of that same year, so about 8 or 9 months later, two of the miners killed themselves who were on duty that day and saw their coworkers perish. And to me, that's one of those ongoing stories. It's that story that when I heard Howard Zinn give his lecture that appears recently in The Progressive, when he gave it in Minnesota, he talked about the number of suicides among Vietnam victims Vietnam soldiers after they returned home from the war. And it got me thinking of those are casualties from the war. And these suicides are casualties from this mine disaster. And to me, that was a really powerful powerful way to conclude this story.
Yeah, and we have those suicides from Iraq vets and Afghanistan vets too, which is just horrible. And they're not on the monuments either afterwards.
Right.
And I happened to talk to a mother of one of those Iraq vets once, and it was one of the more difficult bits of reporting. Even over the phone, I was in tears. So she found her son dead. These two people at the end, these were coal miners. They not only were just fellow coal miners, they also felt some responsibility for the safety, though according to your account, they weren't responsible themselves, but it was part of their duties to make sure the mine was safe. They were essentially exonerated from having any role, and yet they weren't able to handle it, and you certainly can understand that. Mm-hmm. Is the International Coal Group still around, or did it collapse or run away after this?
I believe that they are still around, but the Sago mine was closed a year and a half, 2 years ago because of profitability issues, not because of this tragedy that happened there.
Well, it's interesting, Mark Nowak, that you raise this question of profitability, because profitability is at the essence of this ridiculous school lesson plan that the American Coal Foundation put together. And you interweave excerpts, I imagine they're excerpts from the school plan, as part of the pastiche, the amalgam that is this interesting amalgam of a book. How did you, first of all, find this school lesson plan that the American Coal Foundation had put out?
Well, I just stumbled across it on the internet as I was looking for – I always have three voices in my text. And so I had the voice of the Chinese disasters. I had the voice of Sago, but I never want to sort of put them in a dialectical relationship. I always want a third voice in there so that all three work off of each other. And I was searching around for that third voice, and I was typing in coal – I think coal and school. And I came across these lesson plans that really just floored me. I have a 8-year-old girl who's entering third grade in the public schools in St. Paul, and I'm trying to imagine her coming home with one of these lessons on cookie mining or coal camps that don't mention environmental effects, that don't mention unions.
Well, talk about cookie mining, because that's such a bizarre combination.
Well, cookie mining lesson supposedly teaches children about the costs related to mining by using chocolate chip cookies and paper clips clips and toothpicks to mine out the chips from the cookie, which are the coal. And the kids put together a spreadsheet and figure out the costs of land reclamation. And the text, as you said earlier, is subtle to some extent in that, you know, it'll say like, and the coal company has to return the land to its natural condition. And you can imagine how expensive that is for the company.
And don't spend too much time doing it. They instruct the kids.
Right.
Too.
Don't spend too much time.
And then there's also just straight up propaganda about how wonderful a coal company town is. If you wanted to read that, that might be fun.
Sure. This comes toward the end of the book, Procedure. And it's, again, facing a photo from a mining town in West Virginia of a house that that was part of this earlier round of coal mining. These communities were created by coal companies so that workers could live near the mines. The coal companies built and owned everything, including schools, churches, stores, theaters, and residential structures. Ask students to list the pros and cons of living in such towns. Encourage students to think about what other employment options existed for some of these people who had limited education and skills. What happened when the coal mines closed down? And how coal communities such as these created a sense of family among the residents.
That's Mark Nowak reading from Coal Mountain Elementary, a school lesson plan put out by the American Coal Foundation. And that's kind of plays off your title, which implies elementary school, too, Coal Mountain Elementary. I was reading in preparation for this interview, Mark, a review or a self-description of your poetics at the Poetry Foundation. And I want to talk to you a little bit about that in the remaining 2 or 3 minutes that we have. First off, there's this incredible Langston Hughes poem, Johannesburg Mines, that you quote there, and it goes, in the Johannesburg mines, there are 240,000 native Africans working. What kind of poem would you make out of that? 240,000 natives working in the Johannesburg mines. How does that poem speak to you?
Well, I think that, you know, it's nearly 100 years old, and it probably describes almost perfectly what China is like today. And in certain senses, South Africa as well. The number of gold miners who are perishing in mine disasters in South Africa, I think it's upwards of 70 or 80 already this year. The stories come out every week about more disasters in those mines, despite the work of the union and others in South Africa to try to improve those. So I think it says something about poetry's staying power. It says something about these conditions of labor and the staying power of them, unfortunately. As well, the conditions that people have to work in the mining industry and other industries around the globe.
I mean, he made a poem, even though he was asking a question as to whether you can make a poem out of the exploitation of labor in coal mining. And you are a poet who looks at work issues and writes poems about work issues, among other things. A lot of times, poetry, American political contemporary poetry, a branch of it, or the main branch of it anyway, seems divorced from these concerns. Why is that?
I'm not sure why it is. I know that for me, you know, my entire family, that was what they did. My grandfather was a steel worker. My dad was vice president of his union. My mom was a Rosie the Riveter. So it, my grandma, excuse me, was a Rosie the Riveter. And it just seemed like, you know, you write about what you know, and these were the conditions, and these were the people that I know about. My grandma dropped out of school in fifth or sixth grade to clean someone's house, and I want to keep telling her story and the story of working people like her.
And there are other poets like you who do that around this country, and those are the kinds of poets we like to publish in the Progressive. Martina Spada is one, for instance,
yes.
who's done a lot, and there's a whole raft of others. Of course, Adrian Rich, who praises this book, is paramount. Adrian Rich recommends that everybody read Coal Mountain Elementary. That's the book we've been talking about today on Progressive Radio. My guest has been Mark Nowak. Mark, thanks so much for being my guest today.
Thanks again.
It's been a real pleasure.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.